It is not where you start in life, it's actually where you finish. So I want people to realize that, look, your past may define you, and your past may explain you who you are, but it does not get to define your legacy. And I decided to buy one property at a time. So in 2009, I had one rental unit. 2018, I got to nine. So it took me 9 years to go from one to nine. And then 2019, I tripled my portfolio and got to 35 rental units. Then 2020, I got to 105. So I bought 70 rental units during the pandemic. So if I had those three buildings, I don't even need anything else added to my portfolio. It would make my life so much easier. It's close to my other properties. Extra $5,000, $10,000 is not going to move the needle. So I always tell people now, think about it this way. How often it's very hard to come across really good deals. So be very mindful before you just let them slip right out of your finger.
Real Estate Development, Land to Legacy. Here's another episode where we have a cool and interesting and inspiring conversation with our guest today, Kevin K.R. Robinson. K.R., welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on your platform. I look forward to having this conversation with you.
Excellent. So why don't you introduce yourself, because I'm afraid that I'm going to butcher it. You have such an amazing story of how you got to where you are. So I will let you tell that story, because for the audience that just clicked on us so that they don't click away, this is going to be incredible. So check this out.
So I grew up in Philadelphia. My mother raised seven children on welfare. We moved about 18 times before I turned 18. So I got used to a sense of uncertainty, a sense of living without heat, electricity, and pretty much was smoking and drinking in fourth to eighth grade, was a knucklehead, then decided to turn my life around and was able to do really well in high school and get a scholarship, then go off to work at Goldman Sachs. And then I start buying real estate. So now I'm at 160 plus rental units. I talk about it in my book, Can't Break Me, going from a negative net worth to being a multimillionaire. So that's a quick rundown.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, let's start from the beginning. Obviously, we like to talk more about real estate development and all of the, you know, good things that happen in real estate and trouble that people run into. But why don't we start from the beginning? How did you from a childhood that you just described, how did you get to owning your first piece of real estate?
So for me, it all started back then, I think when I was in eighth grade and I had those three B's and three D's and one C because I'm cute and no A's. And I skipped school and was smoking and just a knucklehead. We lived in a studio apartment and I learned what it meant to be a tenant. And so we kept moving around. And I remember that studio apartment. We had a hot plate, no stove, a bathroom sheet, no bathroom door. We had a bathtub and no shower. And we had 15 people competing for space with rats, roaches, and flies. And at that moment, I remember my stepdad telling me, hey, look, don't be an F up like me and everybody in my family, because a bunch of my siblings got pregnant as teenagers. And so at that moment, I took the perfect from the imperfect person, because he smoked a lot of weed, was a visionary, but he couldn't keep a job. And so I realized that if I was going to change my life, it's going to be because I changed. So then I graduated valedictorian, won a scholarship. But when I was living with him, that time period wasn't much long. He would have us do work on real estate. So we would go and work on somebody's kitchen. We would work on someone's bathroom, their restaurant. So he exposed me to it. And we would walk down the streets around Temple University in Camden. He would say, these locations are really important. Businesses and investors are going to invest in these places. Even though he didn't own a house, he really encouraged me to dream. So he planted the seed and I watered it. So as I was growing up, I realized that these people love me. They can feed my belly and my soul, but my father or my other parents, they couldn't teach me discipline. So I went out and found people that can teach me this stuff. And then it started with the three D's: desire, discipline, determination. Then after that, I said, I want to learn about business, because they didn't understand money management and things of that nature. So then I start learning about real estate. And then that's what led me to going, hey, I want to go to college, get educated, and then I can start buying real estate. So I talk about the three C's: intellectual capital, what you learn in the classroom, what you learn outside the classroom, and also social capital, those relationships that you build, you can leverage them. And then financial capital, live in a capitalist society. So I start understanding, how do you get loans? How do you raise a business? How do you start an LLC? So it all started from there. And then I decided to buy an individual house in my personal name and then go from there.
Interesting. Okay, so knucklehead to valedictorian.
Yes.
You must have skipped a couple steps here.
Yes. So for me, what I had to do is become vulnerable, right? So I knew I didn't have all the answers. So first thing I had to do is get new friends. So I got new friends, people who actually were doing positive things. And then I got in nurturing environments where people pour into me and encourage me to be successful. And so I also made sure that I created my own personal board of directors. So I knew my mother or what have you, or family members weren't that disciplined. So I sought out mentors that could teach me how to be disciplined, teach me how to be motivated. And by being vulnerable, I start filling these gaps. So I had a mentor, Damon Pace, would take me to a restaurant. He said, KR, get whatever you want. And I said, can I get a rip rye rice? And he said, what? I said, rip rye rice. And then he said, did you mean a shrimp fried rice? I said, yes, but you say it weird. And the reason why I said that is because I didn't know how to enunciate words. So therefore, I asked the English teacher to spend 1 hour a week with me in high school to teach me how to enunciate words. And then when I got to Bowdoin College, I asked a theater professor to spend 1 hour a week with me to teach me how to enunciate words because I wanted more for myself. And so I started to set out this opportunity where I was going from survival mode, running around being crazy, to finding structure. And that structure is what made me really change, because I know I had the desire to be fired up. Oh, I want to be something. But I realized desire don't get you results. So I had to become disciplined, where you adopt routines and you actually do what you say you're going to do. But you also need, when you grew up the way I grew up, you got to have that determination to carry you through when you have setbacks and it's easier to quit or give up. And so I started to shift my mindset, but then I also started putting in place ways for me to go from survival to structure to stability.
That is very interesting. That is very interesting. What you said about enunciating words, I mean, English is my second language, so I had to adapt to that and I had to learn. It took me a couple of years to speak the way I do. I still have a slight accent, right? But it took time and it took patience. Naturally, it's been a challenge for me on this podcast. Naturally, I tend to speak fast. And when I first listened to my first recordings, it's like all ums and is and like just the speech is all broken. So it takes time to slow down and to learn and understand that if you can hear yourself and understand yourself, then people can hear and understand you as well.
Yes, I agree.
It's that, you know.
And so you sound pretty fluent to me now, but it's that same approach of saying, hey, look, I have to learn a new language. I need to understand the subtleties and also the rhythm, not necessarily just pronouncing the words, but I want to make sure that I'm being thoughtful and not just saying random things, put my thoughts together, thinking about the syntax and things of that nature.
Exactly. So now we're getting closer to the actual real estate business. Everybody knows that it takes money to acquire real estate. How does one get to acquire that first, that very first property? What was your path? I've heard so many stories from different guests, but what was your path?
So for me, I talk about this in my book, Can't Break Me. It's the three C's, which is intellectual capital, social capital, and financial capital. And so you're learning stuff in the classroom, but also you're learning outside the classroom. Go talk to lenders, talk to real estate investors. You're trying to understand the business. And the social capital is leveraging those relationships. But financial capital, hey, how do I raise money? What programs are out there? And so I always tell people, when you're first starting, and especially when you don't have much, I encourage you to buy your personal name versus buying the LLC. Prior to the Great Recession in the United States, you could only have four mortgages in personal name for rents for properties. After the Great Recession, they changed the rules. You're allowed to have up to 10 mortgages in your personal name. And they can actually be 1 to 4 units. So it could be a single family, a duplex, triplex, or 4 units. The reason why I like that and they have restrictions is because there's so many benefits. So you get down payment flexibility. You could put down 0% if you do the NACA program, which is a nonprofit that works with banks, or 3.5% if you do the FHA program and you have a credit score of at least a 580. Or if you're a doctor or a medical professional or law enforcement, they have some programs, 0%. You also could get grants from the city, the state, or the government, but you have to buy in your personal name. So I wanted that down payment flexibility versus the LLC, which will require 20%. You also get a lower interest rate. Your interest rate typically is about 150 basis points. to 200 basis points below. So if the interest rate in the LLC, they say, we'll give it to you for 8%, over here I can get it for 6%, my personal name. And you also get that 30-year amortization. You get a 30-year fixed mortgage and your personal name versus that 5-year fixed, typically based on a 20-year amortization. So therefore, you're also going to take advantage of the insurance. Insurance premium is lower if it's in your personal name than the LLC. So when I first started, I wanted to take advantage of all of these programs and benefits that are set up for people to buy in their personal name so I can get as much cash flow as possible. And I decided to buy one property at a time. So in 2009, I had one rental unit. 2018, I got to 9. So it took me 9 years to go from 1 to 9. And then 2019, I tripled my portfolio and got to 35 rental units. Then 2020, I got to 105. So I bought 70 rental units during the pandemic. And so I was able to run my own race at my own pace. Some people are saying, KR, you're supposed to be smart. I don't know why it took you 9 years just to get to 9 rental units. You're not that smart. But then once I started to scale, a lot of people say, wow, you must be a genius. Why did you do that? You didn't use hard money lending. It's because I ran my own race at my own pace. So if someone wanted to get started and they don't have a whole lot of money, I would recommend to use the path that I use because it allows you to establish what I call in the book, Can't Break Me. I call it the 3 R's, a track record, build meaningful relationships. And if you do the first two, your reputation will precede you and then opportunities will get much easier to come across.
Okay, interesting. So buying the properties in your personal name, it's contrary to a lot of advice that I hear most lawyers would tell you, get an LLC, get that liability protection. You clearly chose the route that is less expensive on paper, but is potentially risky. Did you consider it to be risky?
Actually, I didn't consider it to be risky. If it was so risky, the government wouldn't put a restriction on it. So the government wants to prevent really, really well-off people. If they change the rules tomorrow and say, I ain't get 20 in my personal name, I would do it. Because what will happen is that I'm not George Clooney, you're not George Clooney. So no one's going to call you and say, hey, you're all up in your business. So what will happen is that I tell people when I look out the window and it looks like it's going to rain, I'm going to grab my umbrella, but I'm going to grab my raincoat, but I'm also going to get my umbrella. So what I would do is get regular insurance on each individual property, but then I also would get an umbrella policy. So the umbrella policy is what really protects you. When you buy in your LLC, they don't say, oh, you can have the loan, don't have insurance. No, they say you still have to have insurance. So the fact is that you get that privacy that people really want, but majority of people are not going to own 50 units. Most people are mom and pops. They're going to own like three units, 2 units as supplemental income for their retirement. So I tell people, why are you going to go through all that trouble to make your thing so convoluted and have to wait so long to come up with the 20%? We might as well take advantage of the policies that we have in place in the United States that could benefit you. So I would go to a class, even though I didn't live in a property, at a credit union, and they said, if you attend the class, we give you $1,000 or $1,500 towards your closing costs. So I wanted to take advantage of all those things, especially when you come from nothing, when you're extremely poor. That's why I'm talking about, like, if you're trying to get into it. Of course, if you have that 20% or you have these large down, go right ahead and worry about your privacy and everything. But I like to be realistic and meet people where they are.
That makes sense. That makes sense. What about working with investors? Do you work with third-party investors?
After 2019 and 2020, I did start. 2019, I started buying an LLC because I already hit my limit. You're going to have 10 mortgages in your personal name for your rental properties. So then I start buying an LLC, and now in 2020, bought an LLCs, and I have partners. But what I'm saying is that in the beginning, when you don't really have that much money and you're just trying to get established, you can't be coming up with 20% all the time. You broke as hell. You have a very limited income. But now I buy and I have partners and stuff at LLCs. I'm just talking about when you're first trying to get into the business.
Got it. That makes perfect sense. Now, help me understand your underwriting criteria. So it sounds like all of the properties that you acquire are income producing properties, right? Which in my world, sometimes we develop to sell, sometimes we develop to own and rent. And what I tell a lot of my clients and partners is that when we develop a rental property, we have to run the numbers in such a way that could obviously cover all of the expenses of ownership, cover the debt service, and still have a margin. And that's where a lot of times the math breaks because over here in the Seattle area, real estate is expensive. A lot of people are thinking, well, I'm just going to build a house or maybe a small like 3, 4, 6 unit townhouse development and I'll rent them out. And then we do the math and I'm like, it does not pencil. Because the rental income that you would receive is lower than your expenses and your debt service. And they usually say, well, it doesn't matter. I'm going to hold it for 10 years and it's going to double in value. Yes, but so I'll let you continue.
And so it's so important that you figure out what you are. Like I used to be an equity research analyst and a hedge fund analyst. And some people would say I'm a value investor. So they buy certain type of stocks based on PE value and things of that nature. Some people would say I'm focused on a growth company. So I want really, really high PEs. And I also, some people would say I will buy a company that has negative cash flows. That was not my focus. So for me, I like to make sure that I'm buying something that actually will generate a cash on cash return of a minimum of 10%. That means after I pay off everything, my mortgage and everything, I want to at least get a 10% cash on cash return. And I'm also going to come up with scenarios, a base case scenario, a worst case scenario, and a best case scenario. And I'm going to apply probabilities to each one. And the other thing I'm thinking about is when I do buy the property, say for 100 grand, I put use a ratio. I only want to spend a max of 50% of the purchase price on renovating the property. So that caps me on how much I tie up, how much capital I tie up to fix up the property. If it requires extensive renovations, repairs, that's not for me. I keep walking. So I'm being very particular about, okay, this is the criteria I use for selecting my properties. I want them to have at least an 80 to 85% occupancy. So I want to make sure that when we close, I'm actually going to make some money at the closing based on the prorated rents and things of that nature. So for me, I'm looking at all those different things. I'm looking at a macro level. Is it a landlord-friendly state? Also, then I zero down and I want to make sure I'm doing micro analysis, analyze 3 zip codes. I want to make sure that this property is located in a community where the ownership is higher relative to predominantly tenants because the owner-occupied communities tend to do better. The streets are safer. I want to make sure it's close to certain amenities, public transportation, airports, center city, buses, things of that nature. So I'm doing drilling down to make sure that I stack the odds in my favor. And I think a lot of investors, they're not focused on that. And that's okay because some people are just like, they just want to have the investment. They want to preserve it for the future. I'm like, no, I wanted to have, it was my off ramp. So like I was working in corporate America, I said, how do I get off this path? And so I had to generate a certain amount of money every month in order to be able to leave my corporate job.
Interesting. Before I ask my next question, can you clarify or explain what a cash on cash return is?
So when we think about your a property, say for instance, I tie up $100,000 for, or make it even smaller, you bought a property for $100,000 and you put down 20%. So I have $20,000 tied up in that investment, assuming I can get it out at the end of the year after I pay my mortgage, after I pay my property manager, I want to be able to walk away with $2,000 divided by $20,000 is a 10% cash on cash return. And so for me, I was looking at the average return from the stock market. I'm like, well, the stock market is giving me like 8 to 10%. If I'm going to do real estate, at least I want to get at the minimum of the 10% cash on cash return. Now, of course, that's a very simplistic way of thinking about it, but I didn't want to overcomplicate the situation. I could have a best case scenario when I'm able to do a cash out refi and get my $20,000 back out of the property, but that doesn't always work that way. So I'm saying if the total amount of money I have tied up in this investment, and I could have spent an extra $10,000 for rehab. So now I need to get $3,000. But I want to make sure I'm getting a nice return in case I can't get out. Because, you know, sometimes interest rates are going high, so I can't do a cash out refi right now. Am I going to be comfortable with the return I have to, basically what I'm getting paid to wait in order to get all my money out and then go and do it again?
Okay, interesting. Now, how did you come up with the 10%?
So I came up with the 10% because I was thinking about what is the average return that we've gotten from the past couple of decades from the stock market. And I had said, if I can't do at least better than that, maybe I should just put everything in stock. So that's why I came up. That's my baseline. Like sometimes I'll get 15%, 20%, But I said, at least that is going to be like my starting line. I wanted to come up with some key ratios. Like I said, if I buy the property for $100,000, the max I'm going to spend on rehab is 50%. If I think it's going to be more expensive, then that's not the property for me, because I'm trying to have these parameters. Of course, it's some art involved, but I want to have some ratios that can guide me so I don't get out of control. Like, you know how some people want their rental margin to be like 1% or 2%? So I try to keep those things in mind.
Interesting. When you look for properties to acquire, do you typically look in the area like where you live around, or are you nationwide, worldwide? How do you decide? And what was your process to sort of developing that guideline or that rule for your business?
So for me, my training is all about having systems and processes in place and coming up with frameworks to make your life much easier. So therefore, other people can step up and step in and apply your frameworks. So that was the reason why I decided to come up with a macro analysis, where I have students and business partners that invest across the country, New Mexico, from Texas to California, they're all over the place. But they're using a framework in order to make sure they stack the odds in their favor. And then once you do that macro analysis, you want to make sure, okay, I'm giving it, if it is some, if this market is, because I have a bias that I want to be in California, even though on a macro side, it said it's not in your best interest because it's harder to evict tenants, or if it's in New York City, that's up to you. So you try to come up with your 10 parameters and say, all right, I got 7 out of the 10 that I want, I can move forward. So for me, it always started with the macro, and then I went down to the micro, and then I went down to the zip codes, and then I said, what returns do I want? How do you think about your, what type of return do you like to use in, and how do you think about what markets you invest in?
You know, it's interesting. So because I'm in development, and my typical time horizon is, you know, about 5 years to develop a permit and build a building, what I typically underwrite is my benchmark is 100% return on investment. So the way I value it is from the day we start today until the day we finish and stabilize, if it's a rental property, stabilize the building. So typically, you know, a year after it's completed, I say that my benchmark is to double the investment. Now, if it's a long-term hold and a lot of my owners say, I don't really want to sell, I want to keep holding it, and I say, that's fine, you can keep holding it. We just need to figure out what we're going to do with third-party investors that we're going to bring in.
Yes.
Because a lot of these investors, they don't like the idea of indefinite hold. They want to be able to get their cash out.
To exit, yes.
Right, to exit. So we have to come up with a strategy where at some point, maybe a year after we stabilize, we could refinance and get enough cash to pay back the investors, or we need to restructure it somehow to get these people out of there. So
yes,
that's what we have to consider. Then what I typically look at is the to ensure, you know, cash on cash, we don't usually track that metrics. I mean, it's in our pro forma always, just like the cap rate. We always track cap rates, even though these days it's impossible to predict. Everybody wants the cap rates to go down, right, so that they can make a ton of money. But I'm like, yes, look, maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't. Don't, yeah, right, don't count on it. But my main thing in development is we are creating value. Today, we just have raw land and we have a little teardown. Tomorrow, yes, we're going to have a finished project. Mm-hmm. What is the step from today to tomorrow? So that's my main benchmark. And, you know, sometimes people look at IRRs. I'm a finance guy. I calculate IRR, but I'm like, look, most retail investors have no idea what the hell that is.
They don't. You're going to make it too complicated. Yep.
Right, exactly. You know, return on investment seems like everybody knows. You know, when we're talking to institutional funds, we call it equity multiple because it sounds fancy. But bottom line, it's the same thing. It's how much money you make on the investment. So
yes,
cash on, it is essentially a cash on cash, right? Only on a binary basis, today versus tomorrow, not on an annual basis.
Yeah. So and it's great because sometimes I am able to do a cash out refi, let's say in a year or a couple of years, and then we got all of our money out. And so the investor, I'm happy, but sometimes it doesn't. So what tends to happen is that a lot of investors, we're so optimistic and so bullish. We never think that it's going to be a pandemic. We never think we're going to have a recession. And so I always say now, I'm just letting you know, look, if I can do 10% return, you should be happy. Now, if we get 50 or 100, more power to you. But I cannot guarantee you all these things will happen immediately. Over time, maybe right. I just 50% over the next 5 years, and then we can do a cash out refi, and you might as well get another big check. But I don't go in there with the mindset that, hey, because I'm not flipping or selling, so I can't guarantee these things. I can do right. my best to improve, and then we can do a cash out refi and get you some money. But
exactly.
I try not to overpromise. I underpromise, overdeliver.
Exactly. Well, and in new construction too, it's interesting because when we look at the project, I'm like, okay, even if it's a for sale product, I always ask the owner, what are you going to do if it doesn't sell? Like in the last couple of years around Seattle, a lot of properties declined by about 10%. And I'm like, look, people who are finishing construction today, they underwrote their townhomes. For example, I'm talking about townhomes because I just recently valued a few projects that ran pro formas mm-hmm. on a few projects. And I'm like, look, people who finished the townhomes today underwrote them 2 years ago to sell for $100,000 to $200,000 more than what they're selling right now. I know that they're losing money.
Yes. And so
my question is, what are you going to do if that happens? Are you going to accept the loss or are you going to pivot? And if you pivot, which essentially means rent them out and continue holding them, are you going to generate enough cash to at least sustain yourself and refinance and pay that interest for the duration of your hold? Everybody knows real estate appreciates. So that's, I don't think anybody questions that. Long term, things are going to appreciate. The question is, are you going to have enough cash to wait that long?
Oh, yeah. That's it. Yep. It's a lot of times it's just waiting it out. You don't, and I always tell people, I've been an investor for 17 years. If you can wait it out, the storm will pass. The question is, do you have the patience to wait 5 years or the patience to wait 10 years? That's why I try to, my partners or whoever, I try to get them too excited. I say, look, we're aiming for the stars, but if we hit the moon, we're going to be okay with that. We're aiming for the moon, we hit the stars, but if we aim for the fence, we hit the ground. So I just say, let's keep it. Let's have that perspective. I'm going to get you to 10% and we're going to push forward. That's the average. It may go to 8%, but at least the value, the current value may be low, but we're not selling. So we're going to weather it through. And hopefully throughout the course of this investment, you're going to be in a position to win. So don't put any money that you can't afford to tie up for a little while with us, because we can't predict the market. We can have another pandemic next year. It's out of my control.
Exactly. Well, from inspirational, I would like to touch a little bit on a cautionary side. I would like to talk about mistakes, about, you know, problems that you had to deal with and what lessons you learned from it. Sometimes the way I phrase this question, what was the worst thing that ever happened to you while running this business? My famous story that I always share is I lost a few million dollars to foreclosure when we had a couple of projects that went horribly wrong. Luckily, we didn't have any third-party investors. It was all our own money, which sucked really bad. And we're recovering from that. But any cautionary tale, any horror story that you are willing to share?
And when you were going through that, your lenders, did you try the loan modification route? They weren't willing to extend or?
No, that was it was a very large commercial development project. So we had, the properties were in receivership for some time. They were trying to sell them to refinance them, but the lender was not willing to accept the deal. So they ended up foreclosing.
Yeah, I've never had a situation like that where I was in foreclosure or judgment or anything like that. Because I kind of like try to play it safe and get ahead of things and tell people, hey, look, if I have a situation like that, the way I would approach it is I always reach out early and say, hey, look, the things are going against, not going in the direction I want. And we can go this route where you can foreclose or what have you. And that could take like 3 years or 2 years to be going back and forth, tying up legal funds. Or what I can do is we can adjust the monthly payment that I'm giving you and let's go that route. But I try to get ahead of it way ahead of time. I haven't had to do that yet, but that's my approach. I think the thing that has been the toughest is initially when you start, like you, when I started, I invited some family members and especially my dad, God bless him, he's no longer with us. I will give my contractor's instructions, and then he will come behind me without my authorization and tell him to do the complete opposite. And so that became really costly. And I had to tell him, he would say, he don't know what he's talking about. He's young. Listen to me. I'm like, so I came and had to step in and say, hey, look, my dad is not, this is not his business. You work for me. Do not do whatever he tells you to do. He can walk around and smile and stuff, but just completely ignore him. So I think that that was a learning lesson early on. But in many respects, my underwriting was very conservative. As I mentioned earlier, I tried to make sure I take advantage of all the different programs. And then when I did start buying an LLC, put 20 to 25% down, sometimes 35%, depending on the building, and try to pivot. And so, but I tell people I'm not wedded to one thing. If I feel as though I have some investments, and as you know, we're dealing with really high interest rates, and I say I want to have more cash and flexibility, I will start selling some assets. So just so I can have that margin. It's like you're running a portfolio and you're like, I don't have enough cash sitting around as a reserve. So therefore I need to liquidate some assets. So I feel comfortable, because a lot of people, what they do is they're more reactive. They wait until it's bad. I look and say, I want a little bit more margin of safety. So therefore we need to let a few of these assets go. I don't care what everybody else say. I want a couple of $100,000 sitting in the bank so I feel comfortable. Because some people say, well, you know, it's bad to keep cash around. I said, I don't know about y'all, but you got to have some cash. Cash reserves, to me, right, is a great thing to have versus tying all. Some investors, as you know, are so aggressive. They'll have 99% of all their money tied up in assets. If one thing go wrong, they have nothing to fall back on.
Exactly. Yeah, I always say at least 9 months, 12 months of cash reserve, just in case shit hits the fan. You got to be protected.
Yes, I agree.
Excellent, excellent. Would you be willing to share maybe some major mistake that you made in your career, something that others could learn from to not repeat?
I think one thing I definitely think that, I made this mistake like two or three times. When I started investing in the Philadelphia area, in the Cobbs Creek area, which is a really nice area, not that far from the University of Penn, and it's close to Drexel University. And I own like on the Catherine Street, the 6100 and 6200 block of Catherine. And I own something like on Walton. So I own a bunch of properties around here. And one property I had bought for $65,000 on the 6100, and then two houses over, I could have literally bought beautiful houses. That house I bought for $65,000. Now it's worth like 200 and something thousand. I put down to 25% and put like probably 25,000 into rehab it. But what's interesting is I could have bought the house two or three doors down the same block. And I put an offer in for 65 and the winning bid was like 70. And now I look back at that, I'm like, that was so stupid. I should have just done 70 because I could benefit. They're right close to each other. I already know the value of the other one when I do property management, all this stuff. And then around the corner was another nice property that was on sale. The owner actually wanted 40. The owner actually wanted 60 initially. I offered like 30, and then I went up to 40, and then a property actually sold for 46. So that was, and that building now is worth a whole lot of money. Didn't need a heavy rehab. So that was so stupid. I was missing out on these deals. There was another one, a 9-unit apartment building, and the owner actually wanted 740, and then I had submitted an offer of 700. And then I bumped my offer up to 715. The owner said, if you give me 725, I give it to you. I stood by my $715,000 and it sold for the $725,000. Now that property is worth like $1.8 million and you didn't even have to do that much rehab to it. So those were the mistakes that I just think was so crazy when I first started off.
Yeah, just a lot of us get hung up on this little difference and forget the big picture. Like, look, in the big scheme of things, that's a tiny variance that really is irrelevant.
Yes. I'm like, oh my goodness, yep. If I had those three buildings, I don't even need anything else added to my portfolio. It would make my life so much easier. It's close to my other properties. Extra 5,000, 10,000 is not going to move the needle. So I always tell people now, think about it this way. How often it's very hard to come across really good deals. So be very mindful before you just let them slip right out of your finger. If you thought it was that good and right, you got to think 10, 20, 30 years from now, don't get tied up with like $5,000 difference, $10,000 difference if you're playing a long game. So I think those were my type of mistakes that I made.
Got it. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. KR, anything else we should have been talking about that we haven't yet?
No, I think that we pretty much covered all the important things that I wanted to get across. Well, the main thing I want to get across about my book, Can't Break Me, is that it is not where you start in life. It's actually where you finish. So I want people to realize that, look, your past may define you and your past may explain you who you are, but it does not get to define your future. And I apply that to everything from real estate investing to business, that you have to realize that if you do what's necessary, then do what's possible, you find yourself doing the impossible. And so that's how I was able to create a multi-million dollar real estate portfolio. Not running at everybody else's pace. Do things at your own pace. It's your race, nobody else's. And I think that's the secret weapon to being really successful in business.
I love it. It's your race. And I'm assuming the book is available on Amazon and yes, everywhere else books are sold.
Yes, everywhere books are sold. I'm super excited. It became a USA Today bestseller 2 weeks in a row. It just came out May 12th. And I can be reached at KAYR Motivates on all social media. That's KAYR Motivates on all social media. My website is KAYRMotivates.com. I hope you guys will check me out, check the book out. I'm giving away the free prologue if you want to get a taste of how I write and think.
Excellent. Thanks again, KR. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Real estate development, land and legacy.